I'm Ennis DeMenis. Join me Friday nights at 11 p.m. for Proper Propaganda, your source for hip-hop dissent, here on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hello, hello. This is Jorge, your hurdy-gurdy man here at Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm here with to follow up on our continuation of our conversations, our last couple of episodes in which we were talking about music of the Cold War. And what I'd like to do is pick up on something that is different this episode. We're going to look at a documentary, a film documentary. By the 1970s, Cold War songs were few and far between, at least in the popular culture. However, in the recent documentary, Free to Rock, filmmaker Jim Brown depicts how rock and roll spread like a virus across the Soviet Union, despite communist attempts to outlaw it. Thousands of underground bands and millions of young fans who yearned for Western freedoms helped fuel the nonviolent implosion of the Soviet regime. This is a documentary that features presidents, diplomats, spies, and rock stars from the West and the Soviet Union who reveal how rock and roll music was a contributing factor in ending the Cold War. On today's episode of Hurdy Gurdy Songs, I will play some of the USSR busting songs in the film and interview one of its producers, it's the wonderful Doug Yeager, who agreed to come in on one of the most hellaciously hot days in New York to be with us. I'd like to welcome Doug. Doug, welcome to Radio Free Brooklyn, local radio here in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Thank you, Jorge. I'm happy to be here.
Doug, first thing, I know you a little bit from through friends, and I have a sense, what I know of you is that you've been a promoter, producer, artist manager, but now you're a film documentary producer as well. And other than that, I don't know much about you, except I do know that you managed Odetta, that you still manage David Amram. Can you just give us a brief introduction to who you are? Let our audiences here in Brooklyn know what you do.
I'm an entertainment producer for the past 52 years. The first 10 years, I worked almost exclusively with rock music. And first started in Europe. First couple years in Europe, then came back and became a concert promoter in Cincinnati and promoted concerts with Genesis, Yes, Allman Brothers Band, James Gang, Chuck Berry, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, Velvet Underground, on and on, a lot of acts. And then I brought, because I had started in the business in France, I brought France's most famous rock band to America and signed them to an American label and toured here. We got on the charts. But a hard rock band which requires a couple of truckloads of equipment, et cetera. It's very expensive. And even though we were on the charts, I lost my shirt. And I was also burned out by sex, drugs, and rock and roll on Marshall Amps. And came back to New York, and my partner says, well, why don't we go and represent folk artists? And because I was ready to become a poetry professor. I just, my nerve levels were that shot. So all of a sudden, within a year, we were managing Josh White Jr. and Tom Paxton and Richie Havens. And I got involved into the folk music history. And then my one partner went off to run recording studios. The other went to run a major music publishing company. In New York. Mm-hmm. And I stayed managing the artists, and then added Odetta and John Fahey and Dave Van Ronk and Eric Anderson, Ramblin' Jack Elliott. And so I really got into music that touched the political and social conscious soul. And so that spirit kind of matched my social activism. And so I was doing that through 70s and early 80s, and then also had the opportunity to produce musical theater shows for National German Television and Radio. So I did that for quite a few years, going back and forth to Germany.
You kept the footprint in Europe then?
Yes.
And you knew what was happening in Europe during this period?
Yes, and I was in Germany when the wall came down. I then the next year co-produced a musical theater show called Deutschland Lied, which ended with the fall of the wall. And then when Gorbachev came to power, I became a consultant to the Soviet Ministry of Culture and the State Department in bringing Soviet acts to America and American acts to Soviet Union. And so that kind of prepared me when this film opportunity came to me.
We don't need no thoughts control. No gas or chasm in the classroom. Teachers leave them.
This, of course, is the very powerful opening of the film, and also kind of bookended on at the end. And what does it mean to you to see these people, these former Soviet people from different backgrounds, different cultures, all singing this song by being bricks in the wall?
Well, that opening scene was actually shot in Moscow in a very large theater, and you had like famous rock stars from the Soviet era who had come together, who had been underground.
Stas Naaman, right?
Stas Naaman, who is the cultural icon and was the first. He formed the first rock band that was allowed to make a record in the Soviet Union, became the first rock concert promoter. And he did this concert. And candidly, he probably was the, in today, in Putin's world, he's the only person who could have done this without harsh retribution from the government. Stas's grandfather was Anastas Mikoyan, president of the Soviet Union. So he's a privileged person, and it's kind of like his personality. He likes to maybe stick pins into the balloons of the establishment.
Provocateur.
Yes, very good word for him. And so he put this concert together and filmed it, and so that became the opening scene in the film. As I said, he's our partner from Russia in the film also.
Wonderful. That's amazing. I'm sure Roger Waters approved.
He had to. We couldn't have put it in the film without it.
I want to play a couple of songs kind of back-to-back to kind of go back to this period in the 50s, really, where the Cold War is kind of really, really intense. And I don't think many people remember, you know, what really prompted that kind of break between the East and the West. Perhaps maybe you can elucidate a little bit of that. But for now, let's switch to, I'd like to play a couple of songs and then we can comment on that.
We'll do anything that you want to do. But not, honey, lay off them shoes and don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoes. Let's go, cat! Burn my house, steal my car, drink my liquor from an old fruit jar. Well, do anything that you want to do. But honey, lay off of my shoes and don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well,
So there you have Elvis and cufflinks with guided missiles and blue suede shoes. So I just want to check back in with our guest, Doug Yeager. And Doug, can you tell us a little bit about those two tunes and how they would lead then into the Soviet artist?
Right. Basically, when World War II ended, a chasm opened between the East and the West. And 1946, Winston Churchill gave it a name, the Cold War. And basically, you had two superpowers facing each other. In time, they amassed thousands of nuclear weapons and missiles. And it was two totally opposed ideologies of freedom of human rights and capitalism, and then a totalitarian communist system on that side where the people had no freedoms whatsoever. People were told what they could think, what they could do, what activities they would participate in. That was very stifling for teenagers. And then all of a sudden in 1955, with Rock Around the Clock, soon followed by Elvis and Chuck Berry, Little Richard, you had rock and roll started coming through the airwaves in Eastern Europe and in the fringes of the Soviet Union. The Soviet had erected 2,500 radio jamming stations around its perimeter to prevent any music or propaganda or news coming through. And the kids knew that occasionally rock music, and they didn't know what it was. All they told us, they said, we didn't know what it was. We didn't know what they were saying, but we knew it was the sound of freedom. And they would jerry-rig radios to get these sounds, excuse me. And so, and it started in the Baltic states because in Riga, Latvia, and the reason being was that they're on the Baltic Sea right across from Scandinavia, so you couldn't have jamming stations in front of them. And so they were able to hear it, and rock music infiltrated and came into the Soviet Union through the Baltic states maybe 8 years before it hit in Moscow and really exploded with the Beatles in interior Russia. And so we started there. We began filming there in 2005, the fathers of Soviet rock. And we also found out that in those countries like the Baltic states and in Eastern Europe who were occupied by the Russians, and when the Russians came in, they would just eliminate, that means kill, all people that had information. They would eliminate, kill all policemen, anyone had to do with communications, newspaper, and they would replace them with Russian people. And so so basically they hated the Russians, and so rock became a fuel for their revolution and for their independence movements. And we have one of the very first rockers, his name is Valery Saifudinov. He formed a group in 1961 called the Revengers. They were the first rock band in the Soviet Union. But for the first year, they played acoustic music because electric guitars were not allowed. Rock and roll was banned, prohibited. They believed, the Kremlin believed that CIA created rock and roll and that it was part of their arsenal, their weapons in their arsenal. And so he then invented the first Soviet electric guitar because he figured out how to do it, and then he couldn't get that electric sound, and he realized that the magnets in the municipal headphones and the payphones in Riga would provide the perfect pickups on the guitar. And so then by 62, he had electric guitar. And Valery, and he sang in English. They all sang in English at that time, which was against the law also. And eventually he moved to America and has a recording studio there and a group. And here is a recent recording of Valeri called Red Hot Lipstick.
Doug, I have a question about Electric Tank. This sounds to me very much kind of like more of like almost like an 80s LA hair band, like Motley Crue or something like along those lines. And
except it's the San Diego band.
It's a San Diego band. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, so that's because that's what he's producing from Southern California now.
He has a recording studio where many people record, but he also does his own music there.
And Electric Tank is his current. He's still working with this project.
That's his current band.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I wanted to go back to again. This is Hurdy-Gurdy Man Jorge talking with Doug Yeager here at Radio Free Brooklyn with our wonderful guest, Doug Yeager, who's telling us about, I hadn't seen this documentary, and I just want to say, Doug, with all sincerity, it really hit me very powerfully. It's a really wonderful documentary. I found it very moving, especially with all the tensions. Because one of the things that Hurdy-Gurdy Songs tries to do is discuss issues that are happening now. So this kind of there is a resurgence of this Cold War mentality, even though it's kind of like, you know, with this whole new Trump era, it has taken a very different turn in that this as we all know, there seems to be like this, you know, relationship between Putin and Trump. And whatever that means and however that plays out, you know, we are kind of watching this very carefully. And so we can talk about that a little bit later. But the film, Free to Rock, really brought out the power of people and the power of a music. And I was particularly moved to see, because I understood you as being very involved with the folk, with the whole, you know, left American folk revival and all those wonderful artists and hurdy-gurdy songwriters and singers. But when I saw you and Jim Brown working on this project, I was just really amazed. And it's really, I highly guarantee it. It's a wonderful documentary, and hopefully you'll tell us how we can view this. I know that you can get it on Amazon. You can rent it, but get it, own it. It's a wonderful documentary and really, really contextualizes, which is what Hurdy-Gurdy Songs tries to do on this program, contextualize what motivated the creation of this piece. Let's move on to someone Pete Anderson, Peter Scott Anderson. Can you tell us a little bit about him? Oh, actually, let's play a song which is not in the film, but just to give a little flavor of what Pete Anderson sounds like. That's not it. Here we go.
Baby, I'm crazy about you. You just won't go away. You with me, then I did. Although in my dreams, baby, I can't forget you. You're so much of my life. My heart still cries for you. There's no way I can hide. Baby, what went so wrong? You've been gone for so long. But I still want you near. 'Cause I can't forget you. Baby, please hear my song. Come home where you belong. And I'll be waiting for your knock on my door.
So yeah, Pete has definitely that kind of a rockabilly feel, that swinging. And yet, tell us about Pete.
Pete is one of the fascinating characters I ever met. We heard Valeri previously. And I should just digress a second that I started this project with an old college buddy from France. And he and I started bringing American acts over to France 52 years ago. And then we reconnected years later. And he has still stayed playing music. And he had a band that had a hit record in Russia, an East-West anthem after the wall fell. And he helped the original Soviet rockers who were able to get out of the Soviet Union. And he had a rehearsal studio for them to live and work and rehearse in San Francisco, and they became his band. Valeri was one of them. So he, Valeri, and I started this project. We said, you know, they wanted me to do it, and I said, well, let's go see if we can prove the thesis that rock and roll actually contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Empire. So let's go to Riga. Valeri will set us up with all of his old friends there. He was able to get out in 1974, but he still had all his friends. And if we can't prove the thesis, it'll just be a nice vacation in Latvia. And the very first person he wanted us to interview was Pete Anderson, his best childhood friend, and they began in the business. And all of a sudden we hear someone else. I don't know who they are.
The Beach Boys.
Okay. Who later come into the film, yes. And so we go to Pete, and here we are, this guy who looks like a Beach Boy. He wears these California shirts. He walks around the city of Riga, and everybody, they speak to him in English. Hey, Pete, how are you? His real name is Pitts Andersons, and his grandfather was Swedish. His mother was from Moscow, and so he wanted to become American since the late 1950s when he first heard rock, and that he embraced it, and so he changed his name to Pete Anderson. And so we sat down in his place, which had posters of Elvis Presley, Ricky Nelson, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, all over his place, and he starts telling us the story of how he began singing Little Richard songs and Ricky Nelson songs, was kicked out of school because of it, and the KGB arrested him a dozen times, and they tortured him, beat him nearly to death.
There's a reenactment. There's the one reenactment in the film.
That's right.
That is really, you know, it's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's what he explained to us was just so vivid and visual, we had to reenact it.
And it's interesting because at the end of the film, you see the Pussy Riot kind of, and it sort of has a parallel kind of imagery.
Right, right. And so, but they just you know, they threatened to kill his family, and his daughter was threatened. They were going to kill her, and then he bore a son. 24 hours later in the hospital, the baby disappeared. They never saw him again, just because he was singing Ricky Nelson songs. And we realized then, if the Kremlin was so afraid of this young guy singing rock songs, they were so threatened by him that he would, you know, bring young people away from the communist ideology, that they were willing to kill his family, then we knew we could prove it to ourselves because we knew the story was there. But we knew eventually we'd have to get major leaders on both sides, the East and the West, in order for it to be believed by academics in the rest of the world.
Let's move up now into the 60s, and I'm going to play two tracks that you normally wouldn't think of as being hurdy-gurdy songs, but I want you to tell us why they're in the film that makes them hurdy-gurdy songs.
Well, shake it up, baby.
Shake it up, baby.
Twist and shout.
Twist and shout.
Come on, baby.
Come on and work it on out.
Work it on out.
Yeah. Work it on out.
You know you look so good.
Look so good.
You know you got me going now.
Got me going.
Just like I knew you would.
Like I knew you would.
Look at it.
Shake it up, baby.
Twist and shout.
Twist and shout.
Come on, come on.
Voices in my head telling me.
My Life Turns Around. Beach Boys, apparently they recorded and they performed this piece actually in Prague in 1969. Is that correct? Can you tell us about why? I know we went from the Beatles to the Beach Boys, and they both appear in the film with these songs. Can you tell us about what was the context of those songs?
Well, we first go through the 50s rock and roll from America and how it heavily influenced the peoples in Eastern Europe and the Baltics. And then as radio stations in the West started broadcasting stronger and stronger wattage of their stations through pirate radio stations, etc., the music started reaching further into Mother Russia. And so whereas it began in 1955 in Eastern Europe and the Baltics, it really didn't explode into Mother Russia until the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Beatlemania started going all over the world. And so when we then went to Moscow and interviewed the musicians in Moscow, they would tell us about the strong influence that the Beatles had on them. And so that's why we had to put the Beatles. And then why the Beach Boys? So you had in 1968 something called Prague Spring, which was a euphoria that went all through Eastern Europe, and the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia, they started giving more freedoms to the people, freedom of press, freedom of assembly and
was
speech.
Was that Václav Havel at the time?
No. Dubček.
Dubček, okay.
Dubček was the communist leader at that time. And so, but you also had a group of intellects, of playwrights and poets and songwriters and musicians who would gather in Prague. And so there was a special bouillabaisse boiling there, and Havel was at the center of that.
He was a young man at that point.
Yes, that's right. And so the Soviets couldn't allow Prague Spring to happen. And so in August of 68, they invaded Czechoslovakia, as they had done 12 years earlier to Hungary. And each time when they would crack down hard on a peoples, in this case the Czechs, they usually had a period of relief afterwards, as if, okay, now we're going to be nice to you. And during this 6 months window of relief in Czechoslovakia, they allowed the Beach Boys to come in. And the Beach Boys had no idea why or how. You know, they were on tour of Europe, and all of a sudden, now they're going to be in Czechoslovakia for 3 days. And so they played Prague, and then they went to Bratislava. They did 3 dates.
Who had that footage? Because that's an amazing footage. We all love the Beach Boys. Most of us do. But I never realized the power of their performance in a live setting.
They had the footage. And they, when we contacted
them. Was it Soviet television or?
No, the Beach Boys filmed it.
The Beach Boys had it.
And they had the footage. And they told us that it was the. We interviewed two bands from the West, and three, I think. I think the Beach Boys, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Billy Joel, all said it was probably the most important moment of their career when they came behind the Iron Curtain to perform. And so the Beach Boys wanted to participate, and we interviewed Mike Love and Bruce Johnston from the Beach Boys. And Dubček had been relieved. He was fired from his office as head of the Communist Party. But unlike Hungary, where they went and they executed the leaders, they didn't execute him. He was still alive, and he was free, and he came to the Beach Boys concert. And they had this idea, we have this song, Break Away, where you're breaking away. We thought it fit perfectly with Czech situation. And at the concert, they dedicated it to Dubček.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I interviewed Jim Brown, and I interviewed famous writer, journalist, illustrator Peter Cease, and who was the MC at that concert. And he said it was a 3,000 seat theater, and there were 4,000 people in there. And he said by the time the Beach Boys were into their set, and they all felt this, moisture was coming out of the walls and the ceiling. And it was like you were in the middle of Niagara Falls or something in this concert.
Amazing.
And the energy and the spirit, because what this did to lift the people, because after the Soviets had just attacked them. Yeah. And so it was a special scene we had to put in the film.
This is Radio Free Brooklyn. You're listening to Hurdy Gurdy Songs with my special guest, Doug Yeager, telling us about his documentary, Free to Rock. Let's shift a little bit to a very interesting artist, an American by the name of Dean Cyril Reed. Let's take a listen.
This train is bound for glory, this train. This train is bound for glory, this train. This train is bound for glory. Don't ride nothing but the righteous and the holy. This train is bound for glory, this train. This train don't care no gamblers, this train. This train don't care no gamblers of this train. This train don't care no gamblers, no big bar flies, no midnight ramblers. This train is bound for glory. This train. This train is built for speed now. This train. This train is built for speed now. This train. This train is built for speed now. Fastest train you ever did see now. This train is bound for glory. This train. This train don't care no lies. This train. This train don't care no lies. This train. This train don't care no lies.
Doug, tell us. No hypocrites. Tell us about Dean Reed. From what I gathered from the documentary, he did believe very much in the principles of socialism, Marxism, and communism. And it's kind of a, well, you tell us a little bit about his story.
One of the most fascinating characters you'll ever learn about. In fact, Tom Hanks has optioned one of the biographies on his life for a movie.
I can see it now.
And here's a guy from Denver, Colorado, who once, when he was 16, there was a wager that he could not beat a horse running 100 miles. And he won the race and won the $100. And he started singing and playing, and by the time he was 18, went to Hollywood and had a recording contract and a film contract with Warner Brothers.
Very handsome man.
Very handsome. And his best friend when they were at Warner Brothers acting class was Phil Everly of the Everly Brothers. And so he's had one single that reached like the bottom of the charts and got him on the Dick Clark Show, which was the most important show to be on if you are a young rocker. And he had small parts in TV series, you know, Cheyenne and The Maverick Show, whatever. And so then he was dropped. However, his acting coach was a socialist. And he's the one who educated Dean into socialists, and he got passionate about it. At the same time, now that he lost his gig in Hollywood, the international director of the record company called him and said, Dean, it's amazing, but one of your records is going up the charts in Santiago, Chile. Would you be interested to go down there if they wanted to bring you there? And since he had nothing else going at the time, he said, sure. So the guy called down to Chile, and they got all excited. And he flew down to Santiago, and 250,000 kids were waiting for him. And he became the biggest rock star in the history of South America. He would sell out football stadiums, you know, before Elvis could do that. And but he then got involved in the left-wing groups in Chile, and you had a revolution going on. And Victor Jara was one of his best friends. Wow. And Victor Jara was killed, and Dean was kicked out of Chile. So he went to Argentina and became a movie star, had his own television show, variety show, was doing concerts. But again, got involved in protests because now America was in Vietnam. And so he was protesting. He burned an American flag in front of the American embassy in Buenos Aires. So he was arrested and put in prison. And finally, his manager bought his way out. And he left for Italy. He was never allowed to come back to South America. In Italy, he became a spaghetti movie star. And while he was there, there was an international socialist convention in Helsinki. And he went to it and brought his guitar. And he was singing all these Pete Seeger peace songs there. And the head of the Communist Youth League in the Soviet Union, a member of parliament, he was there. And he said, would you be interested to do a tour of the Soviet Union? And he said, sure. And so this was 1966, and he did a 28-city tour of the Soviet Union, and everything was sold out because, you know.
He's a rock star.
Yes, from America.
Or South America.
No one had ever seen an American rock star.
But more properly, he was a South American rock star.
But he was an American, you know. So he became, over the next 20 years, the most famous American behind the Iron Curtain and the biggest rock star behind the Iron Curtain.
Was he part of the propaganda machine for the Soviet?
Yes, but and that's how they looked at it. He was a pawn of the Communist Party and a puppet for them, but he didn't think of himself that way. He thought of himself as the socialist peace ambassador and how he would bring the two peoples together and bring peace between the East and the West. That's how he thought of himself.
What was the result, especially why this song, Bound for Glory, you know, given the background of that song, a traditional song covered by, of course, many, many, many folk artists?
Sure. Well, in his mind, this is, you know, we're all come to, all peoples are going to come together, and this is our train to glory. People from the East and the West, and so now we move on to 1986, and by this time, Gorbachev was in power, and so rock music had come to the East. He lived in a little ranch with a pond behind it in East Berlin, and the kids were no longer listening to him as much, but he was making the biggest movie of his life based on Wounded Knee, the battle on Wounded Knee up in the Dakotas. And he was the producer, the director, the writer, and the star. And so you would think he had everything to live for. Though at the same time, his friends said he was depressed that the kids no longer embraced him. You know, he was more like a John Denver. And by now they were hearing Uriah Heep and, you know, real rock music.
Yeah.
And Deep Purple and
Mata Hoople and all, yeah, Bowie.
And so you had that to depress, but he had this film you would think would give
What's the name of the film?
I forget the title. It was never finished. Oh. And halfway through the film, he was found dead in the pond behind his house. Now, it was the middle of the summer. He was in a heavy winter coat, lying face down. They found him in the pond. The West Germans believed the Stasi or the KGB killed him. Because right before that, he had come to America and appeared with Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes, said he wanted to come back and be an entertainer in America.
So he had a change of heart, really.
Well, one interesting thing about him, all of his record deals, he made separate deals in each country in Eastern Europe, he only would be paid in U.S. dollars. He was allowed to go back and forth.
So he was a socialist that loved the capital.
Absolutely. And so the East Germans, they believed the CIA killed him.
Mm.
And several biographies, several docu-bios have been made on his life, several book bios. The last biography, she believed, actually she's a New Yorker, she believed he committed suicide because of the depression that he was no longer beloved by the kids.
Wow.
But nobody, and in the film we have KGB Major General Oleg Kalugin, who was the chief of foreign counterintelligence of the KGB. He says, somewhat naively said, well, for the best of my knowledge, he committed suicide. But he's a KGB man.
Yeah. Yeah. Although he himself was... basically, he left himself, the KGB spokesperson. Here.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, he was, I guess, the most fascinating person I interviewed on the film. I went down to Washington, where he is based now.
He's a professor now?
He's a professor down there. And we set the meeting up at the International Spy Museum.
Mm.
And I had all my questions, and we spent 2 hours talking, and then 2 hours talking about the subjects in the film, and we still had more footage. We still had more film footage, and we just kept talking. And he starts telling me of all the people that Putin has assassinated. And
this is Doug, this is incredible. You know, you're going to have to come back. You really are going to have to come back because, you know, for right now, I want to get back to a couple of songs.
Okay.
I'm running out of time, but it's just such a pleasure to have you here. But let me play, I want to play a couple of songs, little excerpts of them that also appear on, you know, in the documentary. And then we'll hopefully wrap up and talk a little bit. It's just wonderful. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is Jorge. You can always send your comments, suggestions to Jorge@RadioFreeBrooklyn.org. Please, you know, support us. Support Radio Free Brooklyn. We're a 501c3, not-for-profit. And we do local radio. We are free to say and do what we need to say and do. Let's listen to a little bit more of the tracks from the film Free to Rock.
One, two, three, four.
Song became the symbol of the transition of this
was the number one song in the world, The Wind of Change, and it was written in Moscow as they felt the wind of change by Scorpions, the legendary German rock band, and they had just played the Moscow Music Peace Festival at Lenin Stadium with 220,000 people. The first time that hard rock bands came into the Soviet Union and played with Soviet bands. And then the film ends as we come into here with Enter Sandman by Metallica. And it's good to remember that when we began the film 1955, there were maybe 5 fans of rock music. And here we are at a concert at an airfield outside of Moscow with 3 million people 11 weeks before the empire collapses.
Doug, thank you so much for being here with us. Very much appreciated. Let's go out with Metallica. Enter the Sandman.
Poets and writers, allies and teachers, the personal is political.
How's it going? This is Jared Berenstein, host of Famous Dead People, here to remind you that the views expressed by hosts and guests of Radio Free Brooklyn do not represent the views of Radio Free Brooklyn, its staff, or management. Thank you for listening and have a dope day!
I'm not a real doctor, but I play one on the radio. My name is Rena, and you can find me mixing up the medicine every Friday morning from 11 to 1 here on Radio Free Brooklyn. This healing prescription is called oral medication, and it's a formula of choice cuts to be taken by the ears as needed, curated by me to cure you. But you don't have to be ill to take this pill. This medicine goes down real easy.
Downloads of this show are available at Podomatic.com or the Podomatic mobile app.